The Steve Lobby Agency presents The Christian Publishing Show, a podcast for writers who want to advance Christ's kingdom using the written word. Here's your host, Thomas Umstadt Jr.
This is episode 50 of The Christian Publishing Show, and we have a special treat for you today. We've talked a lot with best-selling authors about how they get started, and we've talked with authors who are at all points of the journey, but we've never talked about what it's like between having your book signed with a publisher and actually having it published. It's easy to be so focused on getting that book contract that you don't know what happens next. And if you don't know what happens next, it can be a bit of a rude awakening. And our guest today lives in Tennessee with her husband and children and is a writer of romantic comedy for HarperCollins Christian Publishing. Melissa Ferguson, welcome to the Christian Publishing Show.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
So let's start a little bit before the story and tell us just briefly about how you got your book contract.
As in how I got the book contract, how I started writing, or how the contract actually happened with my agent?
Take us through like getting an agent and getting an editor.
Okay. I went to ACFW, American Christian Fiction Writers Conference, and I actually did not have an appointment to meet with my agent. My agent is Jim Hart with Heartland Literary. But I had spoken with him a couple years earlier about a different book, and I really wanted to speak with him. So I waited for a spotlight session, and then afterwards, I walked up to him and I said, you know, hi, Jim. I don't know if you remember me. I'm Melissa Ferguson. I didn't get an appointment with you, but I'd love to talk with you for a minute. And he said, oh, your book was The Seen Ones, wasn't it? And I was so amazed that he remembered the book that I had pitched to him 2 years prior that he didn't end up taking on. And we just started a conversation from there. And he looked at my manuscript and we talked a little bit at ACFW. And then he signed with me, or I signed with him in November. And then he sent my book out to several publishers. And it wasn't long before the dating charade ended up getting some interest from a few houses. And then it got offered a 2-book deal with one publishing house. But at the same time that we got offered the 2-book deal from that house, which was a great house, a really nice editor, Thomas Nelson had also shown interest. And so it was a little stressful in that moment because while I really liked this one house, I really loved Thomas Nelson and I love what they do. So I went back and forth a lot and ended up seeking the counsel of other friends and my agent. And then I ultimately decided to communicate basically with the editor at this one house and say, you know, I really, really need to hear what's going to happen with Thomas Nelson before I can make a decision. And I totally understand if you have to pull out and pull your contract, and which was hard for me because I had waited like 5 years for a contract at that point. And that was like, okay, it's finally happening and it's a 2-book deal. And it's so tempting to jump and say yes. But thankfully, the editor was incredibly understanding and she was willing to wait several months while I basically was on eggshells waiting for Thomas Nelson. I mean, you have to go through their steps. They had sent it to a team meeting and then I had a group call with them. And then finally they sent in a verbal contract and then an informal contract and then a formal contract. And then I finally signed with them. So that's how I ended up getting, last October was when I signed a 3-book deal with them.
All right. And one of the things I really want to underline here is that you went with an agent who previously told you no. And a lot of people, when they get a no from an agent, they think that no means no. And they're like, I'll never work with you again. And that's not how it works. But in reality, when an agent says no, they're just saying no to that book. And they're just saying no at that time. And this is not at all uncommon what you experienced of like starting a relationship with starting a communication with an agent. And as you grow as an author, you know, that second proposal, that second book you brought was better, right? You'd grown as an author in those 2 years. And while you weren't ready with that earlier book, you were ready with the later book. And if those of you listening, don't give up. If you're getting some early no's, stick with it because it often takes more time than you think to get good enough to attract big publishers.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's so easy at least for me, well, and I hear several other friends say this too. We hear these words coming out of people's mouths and we completely twist them and think, what are you secretly not saying? And so when he had told me at the time, you know, I can't take on any more spec fiction, I had heard, I don't like you and I'm making up an excuse. So then it makes you really nervous to come speak to him again. But I totally agree with you, Thomas. I think it's really wise on your heart to just trust when people say no, to just trust, just have a positive attitude about it.
Yeah. So now let's walk through that first year. So you get your contract back from Thomas Nelson. What were you expecting to happen and what happened next?
Yeah. So I got the contract from Thomas Nelson, and I think what I expected was it to be like a shower of butterflies every day for the rest of my life. I don't know. And it just to be this simple task of, you know, oh, they accepted my book. So great. They have my book. They're going to make it beautiful. They're going to ship it out. And I'm going to like gleefully sit at my computer without distraction, writing another book. And I will then send it out. And I will do that so on and so forth for the rest of my life. And and that is like so not what happens. The reality, on the one hand, it has been more challenging, a lot more challenging than I expected. On the other hand, it's been a lot more fun. Yeah, it's been delightful getting to get to know these people.
So what were some of the hardest things about this first year?
I think trying to juggle. When I turned in my book, there's a lot to juggle with the book that you turned in that's contracted, but then you're supposed to be writing a new book at the same time. So you're writing this new book under contract. You have a hard and fast deadline, but your first book, like for Thomas Nelson, the timeline is that I turned in my book and then my editor spent some amount of time doing developmental edits and then giving it back to me. And then you don't know when she's going to turn it back into you. You're in the middle of maybe writing your next thing. And then all of a sudden she says, okay, take 2 weeks and then send it in again and give me the final. So it's like you kind of need to stop doing what you're doing and focus and go hard on those developmental edits, which for me was really challenging because I've never done major edits before that I didn't expect. I just never had someone else tell me, you know, cut major things that you might be super fond of, but that we think have problems, and then be willing to do that.
Yeah, because a developmental edit is not like, oh, your grammar was poor here, you need to rework the sentence. It's more like, this character doesn't work fundamentally, or this character needs to be cut, right? The story's too complicated, you don't need this character. And so you have to go through the whole book and cut this character and give that character's dialogue to somebody else, or cut it all together, and you have to like rework scenes. And like, it's really like structural. And a lot of people don't realize that those are the kinds of changes. And often for indie authors, they don't hire a developmental editor. They skip straight to the copy editing stage, which is a mistake. So one of the things that separates kind of successful indies from non-successful indies is whether or not they bring on a developmental editor and work with multiple editors like a traditional author would. But if you're traditionally published, you're going to be working with a developmental editor, whether you're fiction or nonfiction, who's going to make major changes, right? It's like your argument in chapter four doesn't work. Like you need to use a different metaphor or something. Suddenly that whole chapter is getting restructured. And for some authors, this is the fun part. Like writing that first draft is the more difficult part, and they love being in the editing. This is how I am. Like I really enjoyed editing and working with a developmental editor and making the arguments better in my book. But for other authors, it is like soul crushing. They're like, but I liked it the way that it was. I don't want to get rid of this character. They're my family. I gave birth to, it's like my own child. I can't kill my child.
That is 100% exactly how I felt. And my editor, I mean, we laughed about it, but it definitely, I was like, in fact, she said, you need to cut this one character full stop. And I responded with, you know, I love this character. I cannot cut this character. And she said, you really need to. And I said, I'm going to dedicate this next book to my dead character because I love this character so much. And she's like, and you'll sell. Actually, well, yeah. So I definitely understand that. And I completely agree with you. I think I got like 14 or 15 pages of developmental edits. And this is like single space, really, really in detail, every single character. How can you change them and make them stronger? This, you know, we don't like, she didn't like the time of the year because some of the things didn't make sense. So change it or stretch it out or cut certain characters or change this entire relationship between two people, or wow, they're just not likable because they did this, or it's not romantic enough. So it's really hard because it's also like you're playing, it's just this domino effect. You feel like if I pull this out, the whole thing will fall apart. So how do I cut what is a weakness without destroying my whole book? And how can I do that in 2 weeks? So that definitely has been challenging for me.
Especially if you weren't expecting it. If you're expecting just to get a bunch of typos corrected and it's like, oh, you know, you need to totally rework your book, which isn't like them picking on you. This is what happens to pretty much every author who goes through a developmental edit process. But if you're hitting, you know, if you're expecting them like, you signed a contract, you bought the book that you bought. And like, no, we bought that book as a starting place to make the book that will have the greatest chance of selling to the most number of people.
Yes, absolutely.
So what would be some tips if somebody's going through this, right? If you could talk to your past self, if you go back in time with a time machine, what advice would you give yourself at the beginning of this year?
Oh, wow. I have a slew. I would say my first tip would be in the waiting, whenever there's a lull, maybe you're waiting on developmental edits, or you're waiting on line edits, or you're waiting on proofs, whatever you're waiting for, make sure you're writing the next book. Because I signed up to have a new book every 9 months, and I can do a new book in 9 months, but I didn't anticipate all the things that I would be also doing that are not related, that are not specifically writing. So always be working on that. So, and getting some writing done. I would say one thing that has surprised me was that there are endless opportunities. And I have felt like since signing my contract, there are so many things I can think of that I could be doing better. I could be doing Instagram more. I can be doing Facebook more. I can have more newsletters. I can go on podcasts. I can do blogs. I can write a different book, write a novella, write, you know, there's so many things you can be doing, conferences you can be going to, networking opportunities. And there are a lot of things you can be doing that can actually be really expensive. And so I think it's just important to be willing to assess those and be willing to say no. I think, Thomas, you say that in a different podcast, like there are a lot of opportunities that can get really pricey. You can add extra publicity. You can add, you know, you can always update your business cards, get new headshots. You can update your website, make it really fancy. You can, you know, whatever. You can do so many things. So I think really setting aside your budget, like you said in a former podcast, and like saying, this is how much money I can spend, and this is how much time I have, would be really wise.
Yeah, that's a novel marketing episode where I talk about creating a marketing budget. And it's episode 207, for those of you who are curious. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. But it is important to not ask, to frame the question correctly. Because if you frame the question, would this be beneficial? Then you end up saying yes to everything, right? Are new headshots beneficial? Sure. Is doing, you know, more on Facebook beneficial? Can be, right? Is doing email marketing beneficial? Sure. But that's the wrong question, right? The better question is, what is the most benefit for the time and money that I'm putting in? right? Because it may be that the email marketing is 10 times more beneficial to you than Instagram, or the other way around. If you're measuring, you'll be able to find out. But the but if you're not framing the question right, you feel like you're obligated to do everything. And so often I come across authors who are just so overwhelmed, especially where you are right in this first year, where there's this expectation that they're putting on themselves to do everything. And so they're trying to do everything and they're doing everything poorly. It's like, focus on a handful of things and do those things well. As the old Chinese proverb goes, the man who chases two rabbits catches neither one. You have to focus on catching just one rabbit, and then later you can catch the other rabbit if you want. But if you go back and forth, you get nowhere, which I will say has been the story of my life for the last good amount of time. So I know what it's like to chase multiple rabbits. And I think that's really good. And you know, the advice that I give authors in your place is to kind of designate a budget of time and of money, because it's both that matter, right? If you're going to set aside 2 hours a day for your writing, well, the edits, they're like tennis, right? At some point, they're your full attention, right? You get some edits back and you have 2 weeks to turn them around. It's like the tennis ball has been hit into your side of the court and you got to fully focus on that tennis ball. But other times, the ball's in the other side of the court and you have, there's literally nothing you can do, right? Because when the most publishers, maybe all publishers, use Microsoft Word, and Microsoft Word doesn't have a good way, if you're emailing documents back and forth, for you both to work on the document at the same time, right? So one person has the master document or the other person has the master document. In my utopian future, where in the future, we're using Google Docs and you can both be working on different parts of the book simultaneously. But that is not how the industry works. The industry runs on Microsoft Word. And so what that means is that you're exactly right in that you can go a month or 2 months with nothing to do. And it's good to have a plan for how to put that time to good use.
Yep. Great.
So what were you doing in those lulls? What did you learn to do to kind of maximize that time?
Well, I feel like I didn't really have a lot of lulls. I feel like between developmental edits and then line edits, which are, you know, the grammar and the spelling and the paragraphs, and then between proofs, and then manuscript design.
Okay, wait. So let's slow down and talk about what each one of these steps are. So you do your developmental edits, right? So you get these 14 pages or whatever, and you're killing yourself, killing your babies. You know, you fix it, and with wailing and gnashing of teeth, you send in a manuscript that's stronger, right? Like, you felt good about the manuscript that you sent in. And then they send you back line edits. And these are more like in-depth edits, right? Like, they're going at the sentence level and fixing commas and spelling. And you think that that's it, right? You accept those changes, you make some more tweaks, and you're done with edits. But no, there's more rounds of revisions. So walk us through what those additional rounds were.
Yeah. And that's the thing too. You might turn in line edits, but you might get line edits back from your line editor, and then you have to review it. So read through and review it and accept changes or make changes. And then you send it back to your line editor and they might make more changes or disagree with you. So you might go back 4 times between your line editor. And the same with developmental edits. If you make changes from your developmental edits and then they don't like it, then they continue to work with you. So you might be doing those process, like going through back and forth several times. So then once line edits are done, I felt like I could like breathe a sigh of relief. Cause then they send it off to people who, proofread it. And during this time, I'm also getting emails about, we're having a titling meeting, and, they sent me this thing called an advanced sales and marketing information packet. So I had to fill in like my long and short author bio, a description. I had to create a back cover blurb, like what would go on the back cover of the dating charade. I had to give cover ideas, and like, which was that was the fun part. You know, like, you think of your favorite covers, and I literally would put those in the document, and they would see like, these are what I'm thinking would be really fun. Can you create something like that? Title ideas. Make a list of all the authors or friends or influential people you know that might be willing to endorse or support you. I mean, it's just like, so you're doing all these tasks outside of writing your next book like this. And then my editor is coming back and saying, okay, we came up with this titling idea. What do you like? Do you like it? And I'm like, her first title was not the title that I had created. Like you're saying, my baby, you know, I had originally called it the Bentley Bunch, like a twist on the Brady Bunch. And she said, we're thinking this. And then we went back and forth a lot, and they went back to the team meeting a lot, and then they had sales involved and marketing involved, or all these people involved that knew how to make a book marketable. And then we came up with, okay, The Dating Charade is a great title, which I agree. It totally is a great title. So, and they did the same with the cover. Jocelyn is my editor. She got the cover from the art designer, but then she ended up saying, nope, I want something different. So then they went back and forth several times. So there's always a process of also going back and forth in between for these different things.
Yeah. And that process is really important because authors historically are not always great at coming up with the best titles for their books. So there was a book that's author wanted to title, Ouch, I've Been Shot. And the publisher's like, no one wants to buy that. Let's call it All Quiet on the Western Front.
Oh, wow.
So much better title. In fact, Steve Lobby's got a list of like dozens of famous books that you've heard of, you know, classics of literature and best-selling books from today. And they're like their initial title that the author had, and like universally it's like the newer title is stronger.
Yes.
And it's difficult because the art of crafting a title isn't an act of literature. It's an act of marketing, which is a different skill set, right? The whole point of a title is that it has to resonate with a reader in such a way where often with just one or two words or handful of words, they're like, I want to learn more, right? How do you make somebody curious? And how to make somebody curious is more psychology than it is English, right? It's like a different school of the university altogether. And publishers have, you know, people on staff who know how to do that. But those people who are experts at crafting titles don't know anything about your book, right? They haven't read your book, right? All they get is the pitch, the summary of the book. And so they need the author to be involved in the process because while they know titling, they don't know the book very well. And the author knows the book very well, not titling. And so when it works really well. Sometimes it's easy to get into fights and people get their feelings hurt. And that's where having an agent to act as a mediator can be helpful. But it's good that you were able to go through that process and you got a title that you're happy with, even though it wasn't the one that you thought you were going to have.
Oh yeah. And I mean, speaking of bad time, I mean, I ended up saying like, what about the serendipitous something? And she's like, no. So I definitely came up with bad titles, and they also, I mean, I think their digital marketing guy was looking to see, he would compare that title with other titles like The Dating Charade or other titles that came up to see like what had been taken already, what would show up when they put it in, what seemed to be the most valuable when you looked up a keyword. So, I mean, yeah, they're definitely very savvy and very knowledgeable, and I'm really glad I felt like I could trust them. And I'm really thankful that I did trust them to say, yeah, you go with it. And I love what they've done. So after line edits come back, I think they end up doing page proofs, which I didn't know about. I didn't know that the associate editor then literally sent me a physical copy in the mail of my entire book. And had me go by hand, which also you kind of don't know when that's coming. And all of a sudden it's, oh, can you ship this back to us in like 2 days? So again, you're kind of like stopping what you're doing, reading for the last time your book and physically with a pen, making marks on it and then shipping it back. Then a little bit later, you start getting advanced review copies, ARCs. And yeah, but that's kind of how that book gets in process.
Right. And you may be wondering, like, why are you still sending paper copies? Like, why can't you do that digitally? And well, some publishers do have digital page proofs. And what that is it's typically a PDF. A paper copy works as well. And the reason why this is done is that there's this process that you don't do as a traditional published author, but the publisher does, which is called typesetting. It's setting the words on the page where the line breaks in the correct way. Because Word does this in a really kind of kludgy way. So no one uses Microsoft Word's typesetting. They use some other tool, and there's different tools people use. But often there's a human going through and making sure that each page is beautiful. And in that process of making sure each page is beautiful, sometimes errors get it reintroduced into the manuscript. And the most famous of this happening is actually with a copy of the Bible. So there's this famous evil Bible. I don't know if you've heard of this, or the Wicked Bible, I think is what it's called. And they accidentally left out the word not in the Ten Commandments. So it was thou shalt commit adultery instead of thou shalt not commit adultery. Your minor change, right? Hey, we only missed three letters, right? It's how big of a deal is that? And it's a very famous Bible. I think this happened in the 1600s, back when they were physically putting the type on the board. And yet it made this big change, right, to the text. And so you want to get as many eyes on that final proof as possible. The other reason why you do proofs often in paper is that your eye will catch things differently when it's laid out the way that it's laid out finally. So you may have had a dozen people look it over and they all miss the same mistake. But when the words are on the page in a different way, the way they'll be finally, they'll notice that mistake. And you really want those people to notice that mistake while it's still changeable, because you know who else will notice the mistake? All the readers, because that's the version they're reading. You know, the fact that the mistake was hard to spot in Microsoft Word doesn't do you any good, because that's not how people, the end user, is going to read it. So that's the line edit. And then you mentioned a term, a jargon term called an arc. What is an arc and what did you do with it?
Yeah. Oh, you can do so much with it. And I honestly was also not aware of arcs before they came. So that's like your physical, it is a book. It says arc. It's an advanced review copy. And mine came pretty early. So you can give them to librarians. I ended up going to an ALA conference that's for the librarians. And they had lots of ARCs that they'll give out to librarians. And then the hope is that those librarians will then order it for their libraries, support it when talking to people, support it with book clubs, whatever. So I've had, you know, you just find unique ways to use your ARCs. I mean, you can always use them when you're promoting it, you know, on your newsletter, you can share about it, but you're also, I mean, you can give it to different people, like different authors that might endorse your book or things like that. So,
yeah, it's a review copy, and the purpose is to use it for promotion. So the temptation is to like give it to all your friends and be like, everyone you mention in the acknowledgments, be like, hey, thank you so much for being such an encouragement. Here's a copy of the book. And you can do that, right? There's nothing keeping you from doing that. Often the publisher will ask you for a list of names and addresses to mail ARCs to. But in some ways, that's a wasted opportunity, because this is a promotional tool. And the best thing to do with ARCs is ahead of time, generate a list, right? Not like a last minute put together list, but like carefully put out a list. And one like pro tip here is on social media, you know, post and like, hey, are there any influencers here who'd like a review copy? Come fill out this form on my website. And you have them fill in some questions where you get a sense of their influence. Because it may be that you've got megachurch pastors who are following you on Twitter and you had no idea, or, you know, popular podcasters who are friends with you on Facebook. And these are people who already know who you are and who already like you. And they're going to be way better to send a review copy than some stranger who has a podcast or some strange megachurch pastor you're hoping will write you an endorsement. And this is so often a lot of authors forget to do this. because they just assume, oh, everyone who follows me, they're a bunch of nobodies. It's like, well, maybe not. Some of those people may be quite influential. And I've gotten really good feedback from authors who I've had do this. And they're like, I had no idea these people were following me. And now they've endorsed my book. And also, you can send them to journalists as well, right, who may review your book. And your publisher will have their own list of kind of go-to journalists and bloggers they'll send copies of your book to. But often you get a chance to send ARCs out as well.
Yeah. And I didn't know, as far as part of this process went, I didn't know that right before your book comes out, like they'll ask us for a list of like 20 influencers, like what you're saying, and they're people that we will send the book out to, or that HarperCollins will send it out to the week before it releases. I don't think those are ARCs. I think those are the ready-made copies. But yeah, so I mean, I didn't think about how many people I've been. That's one thing I've been surprised by is how many people have read my book and my book is not out. You know, my book comes out December 3rd, and yet they've had it up on NetGalley, which I didn't know what NetGalley was. And NetGalley is for like reviewers, librarians, booksellers, And all these people have read this book. In exchange, they've gotten a free ebook of the book, and in exchange for doing an honest review and then putting it on Goodreads and other places and their blogs and things like that. So that's been a surprise to me. And then, of course, like ARCs that have been handed out to different people have been, like physical ARCs, a surprise to me too. I'm like, there's going to be no one left to read my book when it comes out.
Well, so hopefully, and here's the hope is that these people all fall in love with your book and use their influence. And this is where like the quality of the writing really matters, because that's not always what happens. Sometimes these people all read the book and like, eh, and that is what happens, right? That you give away all these free copies and you sell to your friends and the book, it doesn't take off. But the goal is you want to get the book in front of as many people as possible to get that word of mouth wildfire spreading. And it'll either spread or it won't. And the gamble is, right, because publishing is taking risks, you know, very much like venture capital, that it will spread, right? And they've, you know, they did a lot of vetting, right, for every author they accept. There's, you know, many that they don't accept. And then even when they do accept you, they didn't accept you with your book as it was, right? They made major changes based off of their understanding of what will work and what, when people read it, what will make them want to talk about it. Because ultimately, the success of a book from the publisher's perspective is not, did you enjoy the book? Right? If somebody says, oh, I read your book and I enjoyed it, that's nice, but that's not what they want. What they want is, did you recommend the book? And did you read the book and then wouldn't shut up about it for a week on Twitter as you're debating with people about the book or talking to people about the book? Or you love the book so much, you started a reading group, or you bought a copy for your pastor, right? These are the sorts of things that you do when you love a book, and that's what they're hoping will happen with each book that they publish.
Yeah, totally.
All right. So we've walked through the whole process and you're now at the end, right? Your book is coming out in just a couple of weeks. What does that feel like? Like, what has this been emotionally, this process of having to kill your own babies to make your book a stronger book?
Well, I was actually talking with another author recently, and because I've been talking with other authors at ACFW and hearing their experiences, and she seemed so calm and confident, and she was like, yeah, when my book released, I ended up in the hospital for an anxiety attack or something like that. And I was like, you know, I totally feel you right there. I hope that's not going to be me. I do feel like every day the to-do list is getting a lot longer. And whether it's like suddenly I have a bunch of blogs I'm supposed to create, like blog interviews I'm supposed to create articles for, and people will end up saying, hey, can you come on my podcast? Or hey, can you, even just aspiring writers who haven't gotten their contract yet saying, hey, can you give me some help with this? Or can you give me a tip on this? And I want to respond to them. There's endless things to be doing. And so I feel very time crunched right now. And now I'm planning a physical launch party for the first time. So there's a lot of unknowns. I definitely will say I've felt a lot of writer's self-doubt, which is so common. I know we all face it. But I tell you, it's been funny that my self-doubt has been more this year since signing a contract than ever before a contract, ever, which is kind of ironic that I spent like years and years and years trying, and I never faced like major self-doubt until this year. And I think it's just the realization that I feel like there's expectation put upon me that I didn't think about before. I don't want to let my publisher down. I don't want to let my editor specifically down. You know, what if they signed me and have this hope in me, and now people know that it's coming out, and then they read it and say, oh, you know, like, how did she get this? So I think, you know, trying to face and fight that self-doubt is really important. I'm preaching to myself right now.
I know exactly how you feel. And when I was in high school, I was in a choir and I did musicals. And you know, but weren't you homeschooled? Like, yeah, don't be biased. You know, bigoted homeschoolers do all those things too. So we had a homeschool choir and we put on a musical every summer. And I'd often be more nervous after the performance than I was before the performance, right? Because I starred in one of the musicals and sing solos, right? I'm standing on stage in front of a bunch of folks, and the fear sometimes comes afterwards, like post-performance anxiety, which is in some ways is very useful because it's not there to get in your way, but also it's like there's nothing I can do, like the performance has already happened. there's nothing I can do, you know, this isn't useful, and it's not rational. But the thing about our emotions is that they're not always rational. But we're almost out of time, but I do want to ask, like, as you've been walking through and handling this anxiety and going through this and like having your book critiqued, how has that affected your walk with the Lord? Like how has God kind of revealed himself in this? Like, tell us a little bit about the spiritual side of it.
Spiritual side of it, I will say, honestly, I think there's a lot of spiritual warfare in the publishing world. It's just something I don't feel like I've faced in other areas of my life so directly as I've faced right here. I think because it's so easy to feel an onslaught of things to do, things that you need to do, and then a lot of lies being that I might believe in my head about people's reactions or the way that they think. I think that prayer is more important for me now than before I got a contract. Like, it's just, well, and I probably shouldn't say more important, but I just really feel the need more desperately for God to meet me here. And I'm then even before a contract. And I don't know what I would say besides taking time to pray, taking time to read scripture, taking time to honestly do things not writing related is really important. And honestly, I should be doing more. I mean, this is me. I wake up and I know I should be doing more of it. But yeah, so if I was actually going to give a tip to anyone, I would say also don't let go of that. Don't think that you need to be, you know, putting a post up on Facebook or doing a newsletter more so than having some quiet time with the Lord, you know?
Yeah, there's a Martin Luther quote that I found very convicting many times in my life. He's like, I have a very busy day today. I'm going to have to spend an extra hour in prayer to prepare for it. And it was like, that is so not how I am ever. and also an extra hour. It's like, oh my gosh, how much did this guy pray? It's like, how much were you praying before? It's an extra hour. But, you know, having that top button, right, of your relationship with the Lord is the top button. If you get that lined up, all the other buttons line up. And if that's out of line, it doesn't matter because all the others will be out of line as well. So any other final tips before we go?
I would say make sure to have a couple really good author friends that you feel like you can be honest with, that you love, that will support you. And also just make sure you have some really good friends outside of the writing world so that you can remember, like, when things kind of feel overwhelming, you can remember, oh yeah, I have a husband and children and, you know, I go outside sometimes and it's pretty, isn't it? So I think it's been wonderful, the relationships you can gain. I would say make sure to communicate with your editor. I've heard several author friends of mine almost scared to talk with their editor. It's like they'd rather talk with their author friends if they have a question than to talk directly to their editor or to their marketing manager or to their publicist. And, you know, I mean, even yesterday I called my editor because I was nervous. I sent my revisions in for the second book and it needed a lot of work. I mean, she was like, I think at one point she said, from the ashes of this book will rise a great book. You know, it's like, oh my gosh.
So from the phoenix from the ashes.
Yeah. I was like, oh no. So I've been working on revisions for the second book, that are major revisions. And I turned in kind of a progress. Here's what I've got so far. And I was so nervous that she was going to come back and say, you know, like in my head, I started to hear, imagine, like she's going to come back and she's going to say, you know what? I gave you a month. This is all you got. We're just going to have to let you go. There's clearly nothing you can do for us here. It was all a total mistake. And I realized, you know, I just need to like cut this off and like, first of all, pray about it, and pray about this writer's doubt that I have. But also just call her, and it may not be that bad. And so I called her and I said, you know, hey, you know what? This is what I think, and I just want to communicate. Please deal tenderly with me because I worked real. I literally said that. I was like, actually, I also said, please don't break me because I worked really hard this past month and I really hope that it works for you. But I also don't know. And so, and she was like, don't worry, you're going to be great. And she, you know, really affirmed me. So I think communicating directly with whoever you have questions with is really important, and don't fear your publisher. Don't fear the people, because they are just people, and they're very kind people who genuinely, and I think this is another thing to remember, they're kind people who literally want you to do the best you can. Like they're not your enemy, even though they tell you you have to do deep, deep revisions or something, or a title change or a cover change or whatever it is. It's literally because they want to make your product the best it can be, because you know, when you sell books, that's them selling books. And so once I could wrap my mind around that, like literally she's on my team, that was also really helpful for me.
That's right. Cause you've already been paid, right? You got your advance. The publisher doesn't make money on this book unless it sells a whole lot of copies. So they are like very motivated to see the book succeed. And that's why they're giving you the advice. And I love that mindset that you have, that kind of perspective of like, they're doing this because they want it to be better, because they want it to sell and impact as many lives as possible. Because a book doesn't change people's lives if people don't read it. And people don't read it if people don't recommend it. And so you have to get that craft, especially for fiction. That craft has got to be there. And the editor is giving you, you know, free advice on how to become a better writer and how to write a better story. And if you look at it that way, it's a lot easier to take the feedback than it's like, they hate me, they hate my book, I'm terrible. It's like that self-talk is entirely unhelpful.
Yes, agreed.
All right. We have been talking today with Melissa Ferguson. She's the author of The Dating Charade, which you can check out. We'll have a link to it in the show notes. It'll take you straight to the Amazon page. Melissa, tell us a little bit about The Dating Charade. Give us your 1 minute pitch.
Gosh, I haven't done this in a while. Well, The Dating Charade is about a couple that go on a fantastic first date where they tell each other that they don't want kids, and then they come home from that first date and find three children dropped in their laps each. And so they spend the book trying to hide that fact from each other while they sort out their new lives to maintain their new relationship. So it's a twist on the Brady Bunch, and it comes out December 3rd.
All right. Very good. Melissa, we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Our sponsor today is the Christian Writers Institute. And the course of the week is the Tax and Business Guide for Authors. In this course, you will learn how to qualify for tax deductions for your writing-related expenses. And not all authors qualify, especially after the new tax bill that came out. You know, last year, the rules have really changed when it comes to authors, and you may not qualify, you may, and it's important to know whether or not you do. And if you do, you'll learn 19 tax deductions that authors can take advantage of. You'll also learn how to start making money with your writing before your first book comes out. And you'll also learn business fundamentals like how and when to form an LLC and a whole lot more. This is a course that I taught along with my dad, who's been a CPA working with authors for over 35 years. So he really knows what he's talking about when it comes to taxes. He's one of the CPAs featured in the Christian Writers Market Guide. And you can learn more about that at ChristianWritersInstitute.com. Now, Melissa Ferguson, thank you so much for joining us today on the Christian Publishing Show.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Christian Publishing Show. For more information and to get episodes delivered to your phone automatically, visit ChristianPublishingShow.com.